Hello, and welcome to the audio edition of Beastly Business, the first in a series of animal behavior, human-animal bond mysteries, written and read by Myrna Milani. Chapter 12. I spent much of the next day performing the kinds of tasks that used to take up most of my time before I met Monica Sanko and Harley. I finished one article and roughly outlined another, confirmed two meeting dates, and had a phone conversation with several clients and colleagues. Because of this, I felt remarkably normal for the first time in days when I picked up the ringing phone yet again. Don't you ever check your email? The caller's assumption that I recognized his voice as well as the grumpy tone immediately identified him. What do you want, McCarthy? I emailed you and you didn't answer, so I called. Sorry, I was going to check my email after I finished my other work. What did you want? My key. I thought about that for a while, then opted to zero in on the crux of the problem. McCarthy, did you ever think of hiring an interpreter? Go check your email, he grumped, and hung up. Although I'd never admit it to him, when I downloaded my email, I was glad McCarthy had told me to check it. In addition to his message, I saw the long-awaited reply from Jim Godfrey. Do the worst first, I always say, I advised Teresa as I opened McCarthy's message. She thumped her tail once, yawned, and went back to sleep. A minor mystery, quadrupeds, I reported after I scanned the note's contents. Last night, when our partner in crime returned home, he discovered he'd lost his key. Seems he had to borrow a spare from Bubbles. The image of McCarthy in his much too small sweatsuit and soggy sneaks knocking on his landlady's door after midnight caused me to laugh so hard all the pets gathered around me. He says that Bubbles attaches great sentimental value to the poodle charm, and she was very upset. I further explained to my furry audience as I wiped tears from my eyes. No wonder he didn't want to talk about it. I composed myself as best I could under the circumstances and initiated a search for the missing object. Although I normally look for my own lost objects in the microwave or refrigerator first, I couldn't imagine McCarthy putting his key there. Besides, I distinctly recalled seeing the gaudy trinket on the table under the canary cage with his wallet and change. And Maddie. I snatched up the feline culprit and rubbed his ears affectionately. What'd you do with it, you furry demon seed? I demanded. He purred happily and buried his head in the folds of my shirt. No sleeping, I admonished him with mock sternness as I put him down on a plant-filled table. We must return to the scene of the crime. While Maddie amused himself harassing the canary, I moved pots of ferns and cyclamen, seeking the missing object. When that yielded nothing, I pulled out the potted fig on the floor beside the table and peered behind it. Eureka, I have found it! I yelled to the pets when I saw two ruby-red eyes glittering up at me. Even old Teresa leaped joyously at this great news while Maddie attempted to swat the treasure out of my hand. Feeling flushed with success, I emailed McCarthy that I'd found his landlady's amulet. The phone rang almost immediately. Where did you find it? Don't tell me, let me guess. Am I speaking to Dr. Chandler McCarthy, connoisseur of fine interior design and objet d'art? I snickered. When can I pick it up? Came his desert dry reply. It was behind the fig, I answered his first question first. The cat must have knocked it down there. Huh? You ask where I found the key, and I told you. I reminded him patiently, thinking that perhaps a wider gap than that between Venus and Mars separated the two of us. Oh, when can I pick it up? Anytime. I'll leave it hanging on the bulletin board by the phone. The door's always open. I hoped to take the hint and come sometime when I was gone. You don't lock your doors? he squawked, and I could sense another lecture coming on. "McCarthy, shut up, or I'll give your key back to the cat," I warned him, dangling the trinket in Maddie's direction. An extremely loud silence followed, during which I bet his slug daddy he thought some very impolite things about me. "I'll pick it up as soon as possible," he finally informed me in a tone so brittle it was a wonder the words didn't break. "Meanwhile, try to stay put. Do some knitting or something." "Gee, I don't know. Between all the cleaning and baking, there's not a whole lot of time left for knitting." The wave of sarcasm that precipitated my words clouded my thinking such that I continued babbling. "But if you get me some fuzzy pink yarn, I'm sure I could whip up a little cover for your..." Luckily, he hung up, because hearing the final word of that sentence surely would have shocked him as much as merely thinking it had shocked me. In an effort to dissipate the irrational thoughts and feelings McCarthy elicited, I turned my attention to the email from Jim Godfrey. He reported that the lab tests identified the sample of skin and adjacent tissue as capering, although not typically so. "It could be from your transgenic goat," he wrote, "because there's definitely something different about the DNA. We'll run some additional tests to see if we can pin it down more for you."
Yes!
The spattered leaves and plant matter also yielded some confirming and some new information. Two individuals had shed blood in the tiny garden, the aforementioned female goat and a male human. "Get me a sample from each of your suspects and I'll tell you if they match," Jim concluded the message with a smiling icon. I leaned back from the screen so Maddie could jump over the keyboard, relieved that Jim hadn't asked where the samples came from, because I had no idea what I would have told him if he had. But even though he proposed the idea of sending samples for matching in jest, the more I thought about it, the more sense it made. "If we can't find the goat, maybe we can find the person who was with her in the flower beds," I speculated out loud to the cat, who now nosed through my papers. That speculation experienced a major setback when I emailed McCarthy the test results and my suggestion. And he emailed me back to let him handle it. Nonetheless, the idea of getting blood or other tissue samples from any feasible goat snatcher consumed me. I pondered the problem all day and awoke thinking about it the next morning. Only when the dilemma so engrossed me that I nicked my finger while chopping parsley for the canary did my neonatal criminal mind come up with a workable plan. Jeff Weintraub's hand was bandaged, so he's the most likely suspect, I told the pets as I got a Band-Aid out of the medicine cabinet and wrapped it around my finger. McCarthy can sneak over there tonight, find me an old bandage in Weintraub's trash, and I'll send it to Jim to see if the dried blood on it matches the sample from the garden. However, the more I thought about it, the more I decided there was no need to impose upon McCarthy for help and risk another lecture. I'd just visit Weintraub in broad daylight, make some excuse to use his bathroom, a simple enough task for any woman my age, and go through his trash. I made these adjustments to my original plan for McCarthy to stage a nocturnal garbage can raid when I recalled one vital fact that had slipped my mind completely during my previous trips to the cottages. I'd forgotten to make allowances for my suspect's dogs. Was I lucky or what? I nudged the sleeping Elizabeth in an attempt to get some sort of positive response regarding this fortuitous coincidence. Weintraub had his TV blaring so loudly, Sabrina wouldn't have heard a herd of buffalo, let alone me in the woods. Ditto for DeWitt's dog, had he been around. And Jason went to the picnic with the Winthrops. My three inappropriately named companion animals snoozed on. In spite of their lack of response, though, the memory of Sabrina's behavior when I met her greatly dampened any burning desire I had to meet her alone, or under circumstances in which Weintraub would be unable or unwilling to control her. And for as little as I knew about Chandler McCarthy, I knew damn well he wouldn't appreciate encountering an edgy Doberman in the dead of night either. Far better just to drop in on Weintraub for a friendly chat and take my chances finding an opportunity to go through his trash when he wasn't looking. To that end, I played out several probable scenarios while I surveyed the contents of my closet yet again. This time, I bypassed the clothing I usually wore in favor of zeroing in on the dregs. Try as I might, I couldn't dispel the notion that Weintraub would read some sort of sexual meaning into my unannounced arrival. "This should do the trick," I announced to the pets when I unearthed a long denim skirt left over from my granola and sprout days. When I topped this with a splotchy print blouse of weather balloon proportions that I found crammed in the back corner of the closet shelf where Maddie apparently slept on it, I felt well on my way to creating the perfect male libido-smashing ensemble. After I cinched the monstrous blouse with a frayed rope belt the dogs periodically use for tug-of-war play and slipped on a pair of scruffy old sandals, the result seemed likely to cool the ardor of even the most desperate Lothario. A measure of my reluctance to visit Jeff Weintraub took the form of my decision to first stop at the combination Garden Center feed store just off the lake road and pick up a bale of peat moss. When I decided to do that, I certainly never expected to see anyone there except its very weak-eyed proprietor. Alas, my desire to postpone my meeting with Weintraub led me to make that fateful decision. And, in accord with the first law of fashion physics, as soon as I did, a horde of acceptably attired customers descended on the establishment, as if they were lost cosmic particles and it was a great black hole. Luckily, the bale of peat moss obscured most of my atrocious apparel as I lugged it to the checkout counter. Once there, it became painfully clear that the neatly dressed man at the head of the line endeavored to purchase 24 herb plants, each with its own multi-digit computer code, which the scannerless, weak-eyed proprietor and sole clerk squinted at interminably. With great reluctance, I put down my outfit-concealing burden. As I did, the young man in front of me did the same with his bag of dog food. When I glanced up at him, I realized I knew him. "I didn't know you had a dog," I remarked innocently to Douglas DeWitt as I folded my arms across my chest in an effort to cover the most conspicuous blotches on my blouse. I don't. Not here." He looked slightly startled, but I couldn't decide whether my identity, my outfit, or my question precipitated the response. "I took him back to the city to stay with my folks." "How come?" I asked, rather than the more forensically astute but possibly inflammatory, "then where are you buying dog food?" "He and another dog at the lake didn't get along too well," came the slightly delayed reply. "You mean the Golden?" I threw the question out as bait. "No, Jason's no problem." The young man easily rejected the notion, obviously forgetting his earlier claim that he didn't know the Winthrop's dog. "Oh," I abandoned that approach for a head-on attack. "Then you must mean Monica Sonko's dog." DeWitt paled noticeably, but his discomfort didn't bother me a bit. "Forgive me for prying, but was there some problem between the two dogs?" I asked in my most professional tone. A subliminal wave of anxiety swept across DeWitt's face, but it subsided almost immediately. "Harley was very bossy and protective when it came to Monica," he reported tersely. "My dog didn't like that." "Was there a fight?" "No, He made several false starts before coming up with a complete, if unrevealing, statement. "I thought it'd be better if I got my dog out of there so there wouldn't be." "Did Harley hassle you?" I persisted, posing the same question I'd asked him during our first meeting. "No." DeWitt answered immediately, then backtracked. "Not really, but he was, I don't know how to explain it. Watchful, I guess." "You mean fearful?" I raised the possibility to test my own perceptions of the dog against the young man's. "All in all, Harley was pretty easygoing." DeWitt nudged the bag of dog food with his foot when he offered an opinion that coincided with my own. "The few times he crossed the line and I called him on it, he backed right off." DeWitt paid for his dog food while I mulled over what he'd told me. After I heaved my own purchases into the trunk of my car, however, my attention shifted to the numerous bits of peat moss now mingling with the cat hair on my splotchy blouse. He was always hovering around her. DeWitt's voice at my elbow so surprised me it took me a moment to realize he referred to Harley and Monica. You could tell it bothered him if anyone got too close to her, especially men. Do you think his attention to her was excessive? I ask in an attempt to ascertain how much Douglas DeWitt knew about the relationship between Monica Sonko and her dog. Guess it must have been, considering what he did to her. DeWitt stared listlessly at the cars cruising for spaces in the now crowded lot. Did what he did surprise you? He remained silent for a long time before he finally answered. From what everyone says, I guess it shouldn't have. He kept his eyes on the parking lot area. But it did. A lot. I knew what he meant. It had surprised me a lot, too. As I approached the Somerset Lake General Store, I happened to glance down at the Saab's instrument panel and noticed that the needle of the gas gauge pointed solidly at empty and the empty tank warning light glowed merrily. This immediately reminded me that I'd meant to get gas the previous day, or maybe even the day before that. While it pleased me that a fuel source lay so close at hand, paying an outrageous price to use a self-serve pump at the general store didn't please me at all. That pump gurgled ominously, waited just a little bit too long before automatically shutting off, and inevitably was used right before me by someone with sticky hands whose residue hinted at some serious, most likely contagious ailment. I'm sure that at least 20 government agencies capable of condemning pumps like that exist. Nonetheless, it had been like that for as long as I could remember, probably because it, like so much around Somerset Lake, never struck anyone as worth the trip. Considering this in my appearance, it really didn't surprise me when the Winthrops pulled in while I replenished my vehicle's depleted fuel supply. Nice day, isn't it? Hal Winthrop remarked cheerfully as he and his wife, both impeccably clad in the latest, tastefully wrinkled linen designer sportswear, got out of their car. I nodded with equal cheerfulness while keeping a watchful eye on the diabolical pump lest it spew gasoline all over me. Then I noticed Pamela Winthrop surveying me curiously and realized how bizarre I must look, hunched warily over my car's back end in that hideous outfit. My mind raced to come up with a suitable explanation, but nothing sounded reasonable except the truth, which I certainly didn't want to share with them. "Going off to give another seminar?" asked Hal, a question that stunned both his wife and me. "For God's sake, Hal, look at her!" I had to agree with Pamela Winthrop, although once again I couldn't decide whether I found the young woman's lack of tact more or less appalling than her husband's thick-headedness. He appeared about to defend himself, but she cut him off before he got out a word. "Go get some fat-free yogurt while we're waiting to get gas," she ordered him sharply. "And pick up a loaf of whole wheat bread, too." After he wandered off, she grinned at me apologetically. "You must forgive him." She draped herself languidly over the hood of the spotless Mercedes as if she were modeling for Vogue. You'd think with all that expensive schooling, he wouldn't be so dense. For the second time that day, I found myself in the awkward position of not wanting to admit that I agreed with Pamela Winthrop. Instead, I mumbled something noncommittal. Evidently encouraged by that, she chattered on. A lot of his rich friends tell me how lucky I am he married me. She critically studied her glittering diamond ring, oblivious of my sudden leap away from the geyser of gasoline that signaled my tank was full. But he never would have made it as far as he has without my brains. I murmured something acceptably polite, although my sticky, smelly hands and gasoline-soaked sandal concerned me far more than Pamela Winthrop's brains at that moment. but she kept on talking as if I'd begged her to continue. "Maybe my folks are dirt poor, and maybe I don't use the right word all the time," Ms. Winthrop admitted as she gracefully swept a wayward lock of hair off her face. "But if Hal had listened to me, he'd be in charge of the company while his dad's in Europe. Not some flunky." I smiled pleasantly, then excused myself to repair the additional damage the demonic gas pump had done to my already damaged appearance. A crudely printed "Keep Out" sign on the door of the restroom inside the store negated that plan. "Got my Pekin geese in there." The ancient shopkeeper's apologetic grin exposed his only two teeth. At first I wondered why anyone would keep Pekin geese in a public restroom, but then it dawned on me that I'd never heard of Pekin geese. "Excuse me?" I smiled politely. "My dog." He proudly poked a crooked finger at a worn picture of a scruffy Pekinese thumbtacked to the cluttered bulletin board behind him. "Gets a mite snappy when she comes into season. They tell me all of them thoroughbreds do." "You know how it is." Hal Winthrop chortled gleefully as he enthusiastically elbowed the shopkeeper in the ribs. The old Yankee staggered backwards, clutching his chest while grinning idiotically at what was unquestionably, and most unfortunately for him, his most affluent customer. When his labored breathing finally returned to normal, he handed me a paper towel and a spray bottle of window cleaner, which I assume meant I should use these to clean my hands rather than risk the wrath of a menstrual Pekinese. I did. He took my money and gave me my change. I said goodbye to him and to Hal Winthrop, who had amassed an impressive array of canned goods, a dozen cups of fat-laden yogurt, and a loaf of squishy white bread. I also bid farewell to Pamela Winthrop, who remained draped over the bins admiring her ring. No doubt about it. Either brain-sucking aliens or something seriously wrong with the lake water. What else could explain it? You've been listening to an excerpt from Beastly Business, an animal behavior and human-animal bond mystery written by veterinary ethologist Myrna Milani. For more podcasts, commentaries, books on animal behavior and the human-animal bond, and links to behavioral and bond sites, check out my website at mm@mmilani.com. For more specific information, feel free to email me at mm@mmilani.com. All rights related to the book Beastly Business in any form are retained by Myrna Milani. The background music in The Steppes of Central Asia by Alexander Bordin is used with permission of Katova Arts, www.katova.com.